Welcome to another episode of Think Business Futures. On Think Business Futures, we take cutting-edge research, couple it with real-world examples to explore what's actually going on in the business world. I'm David Brown, Associate Dean of External Engagement at the UTS Business School.
And I'm Nicole Sutton, Lecturer in Accounting at the UTS Business School. Some of our listeners are probably already aware of our investigative story into the first deposit in Australia's oldest bank. I highly recommend you go and listen to that episode first before you listen to this one. But here's a recap. Our producer Jason and I recently collaborated with a fantastic investigative history podcast called History Lab. We dug into 5.5 shelf kilometres of the bank ledgers to find out who made the first deposit and how they got the money. Along the way, we discovered that Australia's early economy was pretty chaotic and the creation of a bank was a really big deal. Trust was a pivotal part of the first bank's operating model.
On April 8, 1817, the Bank of New South Wales opened as the first financial institution in the Australian colonies. It was established by Governor Lachlan Macquarie, who advocated its potential to increase the wealth of free settlers and emancipated convicts alike. But when the first customers arrived for the grand opening at 10 a.m. in what is now downtown Sydney, they found someone had already made a deposit.
Nicole, I love that episode. And I'll tell you one thing I found really interesting. And that was there was no bank nor any official currency in 1817 when the bank was first created. So the Bank of New South Wales had to create trust in the currency and the institution.
Yeah, then as now, the customers' banks had to trust that if they put money in the bank, they could get it back at any point in time. Now, banks have been described as merchants of trust, so I thought we'd bring an expert into the studio to explain how banks operate on trust.
Harry Shaw is a professor of finance at the UTS Business School and has studied banks at length. Harry, could you explain to us why banks are actually in the business of trust?
Let me be a bit broader. I think why are banks in the business at all? Banks provide services that are valuable to society. I'll give you a few examples. They pretty much facilitate any form of payment between individuals. They also allow people to manage life cycle effects. What I mean with that is they allow young people to borrow money to fund their studies or fund a first home or first car. And in later stages where you tend to have more money than you spend, they provide people with saving facilities. And so with that, they provide a very essential, intangible infrastructure to a society. And this is where they earn their money with, but also this is why we need them. And the trust comes in because we trust that this facility is available at all times. And so with that, I think this trust that the society and individuals put into banks is fairly large. And it's a foundation of banking.
Can I pick up on this and just kind of drill down a little bit more about this? Why is it that a loss of trust could be so detrimental to a bank?
I think there are different levels of trust. Mm-hmm. The first level regards the availability of services. But there's more to it. There are particular financial products. We spoke about deposits, the first deposit in Australia. In that instance, you rely on the repayment of that deposit. But also institutions are fairly integrated in the broader economic activity and a major pillar of what we call resilience in the financial market. And at any level, when institutions fail or the trust is broken, it causes damage, and it is the first layer is obviously the loss of the individual, and that is a very negative outcome. But there are also broader things at play, such as the stability of a financial system, and it is feedback effects that go beyond the loss of individuals. So those it has the possibility to create larger losses, not on we call it in finance an idiosyncratic loss, but a large-scale systematic loss that involves many individuals, in the worst case, a whole society or a whole region or the whole world.
And so this is some of the things that we saw happening in the global financial crisis.
Yes, it wasn't. The global financial crisis was pretty bad and was systemic, but it was isolated in a way to regions.
this idea about the fundamental trust depositors have when they put their money into a bank. This relates to this idea about, I've heard this phrase, a run on a bank. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what this is and why it occurs?
So runs on banks generally occur in countries where the government does not back up the banks. I need to put this up front because in Australia, the government through APRA runs what is called the financial claims scheme, which is effectively a guarantee of deposits up to 250,000 per account. Similar systems exist in other countries like the US with the FDIC deposit insurance. But in countries where this does not exist, and one example would have been the UK during the global financial crisis, what happens if the people anticipate that a bank is not doing well, immediately they withdraw the funds and they cause a liquidity squeeze on the bank, which has to pay out the deposits in a very short period of time and often does not have the liquid assets, that is the cash, to make this payout. And if a bank is unable to make the payout effectively, it has to go for bankruptcy.
So this is where you see those long lines of queues
exactly.
of people at ATMs.
It goes very quickly. Similar in Greece, it goes very quickly. It can, within a matter of half a day, by spreading the word of mouth, cause all the depositors to withdraw their funds through online facilities or personally in the branches. And that can happen within a few hours.
Wow. And so this is what happened. This is one instance, as if there's a fundamental breakdown in trust by depositors, very quickly this
right.
could lead to a bank running out of liquid assets.
Exactly. And so with that, the trust is reciprocal because the trust is coming from the consumer, but also from the institution. So, and you know, the trust from the institution is institutions, they do actually fairly good planning on the withdrawal of deposits. And so they know exactly that just lead up to Christmas, people withdraw more of the funds because they need to buy Christmas presents. And they know funds are more withdrawn on a Friday and a Saturday as people go out to spend. And they basically anticipate these withdrawal patterns. But in a crisis where there's sort of this run on a bank, this does no longer hold and withdrawals exceed by far the plannings of institutions. And it's usually then not possible for some banks to provide this liquidity needed.
Now, as you know, we've been looking at how historically banks, in particular the Bank of New South Wales, which has now become Westpac, tried to create trust 200 years ago. And we spoke with a historian, his name was Aaron Graham, who explained some of the context and the environment in which the first bank was formed.
As to why a bank was necessary, I think it goes back to the situation that he finds himself in 1810, where there's a great deal of political unrest. And I think he perhaps feels that by making these people shareholders, by giving them a stake in the economy of the colony, this may be a way to diffuse some of that.
Now, I want to fast forward to today. How do banks build and maintain trust now?
It's a good question. So good that I have to think a little while. I think banks in today's context, they are very different to banks 20 years ago. And there's a history that has to be told. Many banks in the past have come out of large funds. And what I mean with that is either they were established by governments and or by very large, rich individuals. One of the first banks was actually a privately funded bank. And so what happens is banks often are companies that would not exist by themselves. In a free market, it's very fairly hard to establish a bank. In order to get that trust, what you need is the backing of something like a sovereign. And so this is where, in early days, countries and governments came in and set up banks. And to my knowledge, Westpac is not the only one that has its roots in the government sector. I would argue many of the large Australian banks have the same. There was this episode, it might have been in Australia 200 years ago, where governments let go and privatized banks and made them companies. And that goes well, usually, for a couple of years until companies often favor short-term profit versus long-term sustainability. And in business cycles, in economic downturns, often that causes troubles with various outcomes. And a bank, a run on the bank could be one scenario. But you are in situations, because of the importance of banks, where often privately run institutions have to then be rescued by the broader society. And this has not happened in Australia for a long period of time, but it has happened in other geographies. And the human societies globally have recognized the problem and have established institutions to avoid basically banks running into problems. And banking in particular is one of the few industries that are globally governed because of this. And over the last, in particular over the last 30 to 40 years, there's been a number of institutions established. In the olden days, much of that was regulated through the central bank. But in the olden days, in the last 40 years, much of that was shifted to the global level through the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. That brings us to the next institution. They have founded the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which from 1988 onwards has established bank regulation laws, which are then adopted by governments globally, and then effectively limiting institutions in the unregulated course of business. So what it does mean, for instance, in today's world, that banks have limits, basically floors on bank capital ratio. What it effectively does is it limits the amount of dividends that can be paid out to shareholders. And also there are numerous rules and regulations around business conduct. And these rules effectively are replacing what governments in the olden days would have done on their own accounts when banks were under their ownership. And what has happened since the global financial crisis was, again, a move towards more government control, where globally new roles were crafted, limiting the activities of banks.
So basically, it's the regulatory environment and regulators that then provide that level of stability that then enables the trust to be had in an institution
right.
which is privately owned.
Right, and that's correct. And the whole issue is very complicated. So in Australia, if I just quickly can describe that, we have three regulators. We have the Australian Securities and Investments Commission that predominantly regulates the conduct with consumers.
Yep, so that's ASIC. Yep.
ASIC. And then we have the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority that regulates in particular the resilience of banks with a focus on the trust of depositors, that depositors are repaid when they want to be repaid.
Mm-hmm. So depositors are a big fan of APRA. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we have the Reserve Bank of Australia that effectively maintains the financial system stability. And they basically have a close eye on how banks interact with other institutions in the market space. And together, these regulators have different mandates, they have different regulations, but they basically ensure that we can trust banks.
You're listening to Think Business Futures. To download this show, head to 2ser.com or your favourite podcast app and look for Think Business Futures. On this episode, we're exploring why trust is so fundamentally important to banks. And here to explain this to us is Harry Shull from the UTS Business School. If you haven't listened to our episode titled The Bank, The Sergeant and His Bonus, we highly recommend you go and do that. It's all about the first deposit into Australia's oldest bank. I promise, you'll love it. Dave did.
It was pretty awesome. How do you think this issue of trust and the regulatory environment has been impacted by or changed since the Banking Royal Commission?
I think the level of trust as a whole is something that has is earned or is created over a long period of time. I'm not sure what couple of months will change in terms of the level of trust. I think today we still rely on the banks as much as we did before the commission, but it has created awareness. It has created awareness of a number of misconduct cases in the banking industry, although these misconduct cases also have to be seen in the volumes and numbers of transactions that banks conduct each and every day. To give you a few numbers, the Australian banking system has approximately size in terms of total assets of $3 trillion Australian dollars. It is three times as large as the market capitalization of the ASX. the number of transactions conducted by institutions servicing 20 million, 25 million Australians monthly is in the billions. There's a lot of activity that the banks undertake relative to the cases that have been made public and have been reported in the media in the last months during the Royal Commission. And the banks are working hard to ensure that these similar cases do not happen in the future.
For me, having listened to you talk about the net of regulation that sits at both a global level and then within Australia, and we have these regulations and these safeguards in place and these rules to ensure that misconduct doesn't occur or that the banks are not taking undue levels of risk and not putting our financial sector into in a precarious state. How is it then that we have had instances of misconduct and we have had things that have required a royal commission into the banking sector?
Yeah, first, I think the banking system, as said, is very important to every one of us. And so with that, whether it was the Royal Commission, but always previously we had the Murray Inquiry in Australia in 2013, it just shows the importance of that system. And can be measured in terms of GDP. The banking system is a major contributor to the Australian output, productivity. And so with that, I think any inquiry or Royal Commission is valuable because at the end of the day, it makes a system, if it is already strong, even stronger. And so one can only welcome that commission. So the Royal Commission has created awareness of these misconduct cases. And with that, a lot of individuals in dealing with the banks, I think they are more careful and they also will consult or are consulting more public sources, things like the internet. They use rate comparison tables more. But it has also created a bit of call it a fear amongst the banking community of doing things wrongly. And so now there's a negative feedback on our economy as well. And so what the Commission has created is a little bit less of a trust from the banker's side on their customers. And so we've had these discussions in relation to banks lowering the lending volumes made available that then had a negative impact on for example, housing prices, in particular in Sydney and Melbourne. But there are other consequences also attached to that rather than rectifying misconduct cases.
And listen to you talk. Having understood, and this is a point you made before, the importance of the trust building that happens from the regulatory point of view, the sense that we have trust in banks because they sit within a strong regulatory environment, now I understand also why there has been so much heat on the regulators at the Commission as well as the banks, because it's not just the fact that there's been misconduct, but there's been misconduct and they haven't necessarily enforced this. And we need strong regulators in order to have trust in those institutions.
Yeah, that is correct. The government has done a little bit in the last budgets. They have made more resources to regulators available, but this is always relative. More resources than in the prior year have been made available, but some people call for a further increase.
Are there any other things that individual banks can do to build the trust by members in the community? Because, so, for example, if we go back 200 years, one of the really important features was at the Bank of New South Wales that the clerks, they had amazing penmanship because there was the integrity in their writing spoke to the integrity of the deposits and the fact that you'd be able to see legibly where the deposits were.
Sir Alexander Burt looks like an overseer.
Again, the penmanship here is amazing.
Yeah. So, as I said earlier, the people were actually employed for their ability to keep really, really neat accounts like this and to be able to add up those incredibly long columns of figures accurately.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Are there things that individual banks are doing to differentiate themselves or to build trust in themselves as individual institutions?
Yeah, so I think all the institutions work very hard in understanding the customers. Banks have grown over the years in size. And so today, banks service a much larger customer base than they had historically. And so with that, banks are building very hard, call it internal review systems, which they can roll out over millions of customers and accounts. And so these are an ongoing exercise. And there will be a much greater emphasis on early warning system, early identification of such misconduct cases, and much greater enforcement of these processes internally.
Okay, so that kind of takes us to the last question. And you've kind of answered it a little bit, but I just want to deal with this head on. And the question is, so what? Why do we care? Say we, as society, lose faith in the banks and they fail, or an individual bank fails. So what?
I think individuals, we just need the banks. Most so to be able to finance our lifestyle at times where we do not have money. And it's an intergenerational transfer. And without the banks, young people would not be able to build or own houses. And I think banks in this intergenerational transfer provide the most valuable service to us. There's no alternative to the banking system to date. It's always been argued that the evolution of the internet and fintech companies can provide competition, but they are not able to provide that at this stage. And so without banks, our economy wouldn't function. We wouldn't be able to do many things that are dear to us.
So what you're telling us is that life as we know it in a Western capitalist economy, and perhaps more broadly, would not exist without a healthy banking sector.
There are direct and indirect measures, and you can pin it to a number. 15% of the life you get used to it directly would not exist without the banks, and there are other feedback effects that would follow if we take the banks away.
What do you mean by that, 15%?
That's approximately the importance of the banking system in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you take out banks and then immediately 15% gets wiped.
But the other thing, it's interesting that point. I remember a number of years ago, and I was talking with Nicole about this recently, and Jason actually, one of the banks ran this ad on television. It might be 15 years ago now, I think about it, time flies, but it was about the role of banks in the importance of your life cycle. And this particular bank was, you know, painting this picture of how they've been there at every step of the way, you know, when you bought your first car, when you bought your first house, and they created this real nostalgic picture of their place in the development of one's life. Now, they got a lot of pushback on it at the time because it's like, well, you're only making money out of this, you're not that important. But as an independent researcher, the point that you're making to us, that message in actual fact is right. The banks are absolutely central to our capacity to build and maintain a life in the kind of economic environment that we operate in currently.
Yeah, I mean, banking is an infrastructure. It's important as much as roads and bridges are. It's just the big problem in banking is that we can't touch it. A lot of it is digital, and many people do not appreciate things that are intangible.
Yeah, well, you know what? Having looked back 200 years to the time before there were banks, I have a newfound appreciation for how hard life was without that, and how hard it was for the economy to function without them. So, you're right. We do need them. And from what you're saying also, it's not just that we need them, but we also need to trust them. So hopefully we can get back to a point, if that's been damaged in recent years, hopefully we can get back to a point that we can actually trust banks again.
Harry, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today. You have really helped us appreciate the significance and importance of banks, their operation, and also this role of trust in operation. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the close of this episode of Think Business Futures. Our show is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. We'd like to pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. This podcast is made by the UTS Business School with the support of 2SER 107.3. Our executive producer is Jason Lequier. Ben Robinson provides additional production support. For more information on Harry's work, you can visit the UTS Business School website. Until next time.